Session number 14128, Frederick Parham, Reel 4.
But now, there were no big ships left which could attack the convoys, and so they went on, but with no thought of danger from large ships, which meant that quite a number of large battleships and so on were able to leave the home fleet and to go east to join in the Japanese war.
My admiral, Robert Burnett, who had shortly before been promoted to vice admiral, was made a KBE as an honor for this battle. I don't think I can resist reading a letter which I received shortly after the battle from Lord Fraser's predecessor as Commander-in-Chief of the Home Fleet, Lord Tovey, who was then Admiral, Commander-in-Chief of the Nore. He wrote, "I was following your intercepts on the chart, and I knew that you and your fine ship flying Bob Burnett's flag would never let go of the brute unless the weather made it absolutely impossible for you to keep up. The combination of the gannet attack you and the other cruisers made on the Scharnhorst, coupled with your magnificent shadowing, is as fine an example of cruiser work as has ever been seen." Well, as I said, we went back to Scarpa, and then shortly after we got to Scarpa, my Admiral Robert Burnett was relieved by Vice Admiral Frederick Dalrymple Hamilton, another very, very charming man. I can't remember very much about what happened in the next few months, but very shortly we were busy preparing for the invasion of Normandy, in which we were to lead one of the bombarding squadrons in. And shortly before we left Scarpa for the invasion, the fleet was visited by His Majesty the King, and he embarked in the Belfast, and I took him all round the fleet and eventually back to the mainland. And I remember that when we were waiting, having anchored off the North Shore of Scotland, for his baggage and so on to be transshipped, he sent for me in the after cabin, and really, quite shyly, he was sort of fumbling about in his breast pocket, and eventually produced a signed photograph of himself, saying, "I wondered whether you would like this." Well, shortly after that we left for the Clyde and joined up with the other ships coming with us for the invasion of Normandy, and eventually we set forth. You may remember that the D-Day had to be postponed by 24 hours because of bad weather, which was a little trying to the nerves. We turned back, steamed the way we'd come for 12 hours, and then turned back and steamed back over it again for the next 12 hours. Remember that was the only occasion during the 2 years I was in command that I addressed the ship's company over the loudspeaker. I always said that when I talked to my men, I like to see them, because in this case it's impossible, and I spoke to them over the loudspeaker and told them exactly what we were going to do. The bombarding squadron led by the Belfast passed down the channel which had been cleared of mines. There was a very strong cross tide running, and we had, by the program which had been worked out in the minutest detail, to pass during that time, overtake and pass, myriads of landing craft full of soldiers. Thank heaven there was a full moon, because I think we were always continuously under helm, dodging these landing craft, and if there hadn't been a full moon, I tremble to think how many of them we might have sunk. We opened fire, I think it was about 5:30 in the morning, on pre-arranged targets. And at about 7 o'clock in the morning, when the army had just about touched down and were landing, I seized the opportunity of looking down to the bridge for a moment to go into the chart house, where all of the arrangements for bombarding were being carried on. And in the chart house there was a loudspeaker which was connected to the ordinary BBC broadcast. And as I came in to the chart house about 7:10 on the morning of what I suppose was really one of the greatest and most important days in the whole history of the Empire, a voice from the loudspeaker said, "Now then, girls, are we all ready?" And then stretch the arms, stretch the legs. It was Mae Brown doing the morning exercises. Really, honestly, what a country. Anyway, we carried on in fits and starts, bombarding, first of all, as I said, pre-arranged targets, and then later when the army was ashore, we were answering calls for fire wherever they were required. And I shall never forget that at about 5 or 6 o'clock that evening, we were actually anchored off the coast of Normandy, I suppose about 5 miles out or something like that, this coast which had been denied to us for over 5 years. We were there altogether for nearly 5 weeks. In fact, we were the first to arrive and almost the last ship to leave the area. And during the whole of those 5 weeks, the only let up we had was two quick trips back to Portsmouth for more ammunition. We did, in fact, altogether fire something like 5,000 rounds of 6-inch projectiles. The German aircraft they never dared appear in daylight, but they started to come out at night, and they started laying these things called oyster mines, which really were rather a trap, because they were touched off simply by the passage of a ship over them. Now I remember that the rule was, when these mines had been laid, that we were allowed to proceed on one engine only out of our four, going either slow ahead or slow astern. It meant, of course, that the nights were pretty broken and one didn't get much sleep. And during the day, it was off and on all the time, waiting for calls from the army and trying to make quite sure that they weren't bogus ones from the Germans, which was a little tricky at times. But there we stayed, down the eastern end of the bombardment area, and that's really, I think, why we stayed so much longer than anybody else, because it was there that the army got held up in front of Caen, and therefore the Germans remained within range of our guns for a good deal longer than they did further west. And during that period, after a few weeks, all sorts of things used to come out from Le Havre, human torpedoes and motor torpedo boats and so on, bent on us, of course. And I remember one evening, we and one other ship, I think, were all alone down the eastern end and quite unprotected from the air or from these human torpedoes or whatnot. And about 3 or 4 miles further west was where the merchant ships all congregated, and one or two other bombarding ships with them. And they were always very nicely covered by a splendid smoke screen all night. And so I suggested to my admiral that here we were now, the moon was once again full, it was about a month later, and that we were sticking out like haystacks down the eastern end. Wouldn't it be quite a good idea, even though we had to do it very slowly, to get up under the cover of this smoke screen? And my admiral looked at me, I think rather, as if he thought I got cold feet, which of course I had, but eventually agreed. And so we moved up very, very slowly and joined the throng under this nice protective smoke screen. And that very night we used to listen in to the German wireless telephoning going on between the motor torpedo boats and so on, which had come out for us. And we actually heard one evening one chap telling another in German exactly where the Belfast was by name. And it was where we were, but fortunately we were not there then. Well, finally the army progressed and all of them were, the enemy had passed out of the range of our guns and we left the bombardment area. We went up to Scarpa for a short time and then finally down to the Tyne to refit and make the ship ready to join the Far Eastern Fleet in the war against the Japanese. And I then left the ship and turned her over to another captain. During my time in the ship, we steamed 63,091 miles in 20 months, and I left the ship very sadly. After that, I was appointed to the Admiralty, first of all as Director of Operations, brackets foreign, as opposed to brackets home, and then when the war with Germany was over, I was the first peacetime combined Director of Operations Division for the whole outfit. It was an interesting time, not very comfortable. I used to sleep in what's called, used to be called Lenin's Tomb, which was a sort of bomb-proof and everything else-proof addition which they'd made to the Admiralty, and I slept well down below ground while all the flying bombs and things were about, so that was nice and peaceful. I remember I used to nip over and have my shave and breakfast at the club and then go back to work. But I did get most of my weekends at home. I say it was an interesting time, but I think probably the least happy time of my period in the Royal Navy, largely I think because I didn't frankly like the chap that I was working under. But at the end of that, very, very thrilling, I was appointed in command of the Vanguard, a splendid new battleship which had been completed after the end of the war. She was a huge ship, 814 feet long, 108 feet beam, and 51,000 tons displacement, carrying 8 15-inch guns, 16 5.25 guns, and a large number of smaller guns. I was terribly proud of that command. I remember that over and over again, standing on the bridge and looking down at this great ship and saying to myself, well, however high I may climb up the ladder after all this, this is the great moment of my life, and I really think it was. I took command of the ship at Portsmouth on her return from taking the King and the Royal Family around South Africa. And shortly afterwards, we moved out of Devonport to recommission. And then there was a bit of a sort of, we went to the doldrums for a bit then, because nobody quite knew what was going to happen to us next. My wife, of course, came down to Plymouth, and we had a very nice little flat in a house, I suppose about 7 or 8 miles outside Plymouth. One of the amusing things about that was that, of course, rations were still very much in force. I used to go ashore to supper every night, but I hadn't got a ration book. And I had the most charming steward who was always getting at me and saying, well, why on earth don't you take a little meat or a little something with you, or butter and that sort of thing? In fact, sometimes when he gave me a packet of laundry to take home with me. I used to find some of this stuff secreted in among the laundry. But he kept on at me about this, and I remember saying to him one day, when I look her back, you must realize, surely, that I am the last man in the ship who can break the rules. And he replied to me, well, sir, surely you must realize that you'd be the last man in the ship to be bowled out if you did. Well, after a bit of a wait came the glorious news that we were going to do a royal tour with the King, the Queen, and the Princess Margaret. Princess Elizabeth had by then been married. We were going out through the Panama Canal to visit New Zealand and Australia, and then back round the Cape. We competed up to full complement, and then went out to Malta for, I think it was about 6 weeks or so, to work up. I was determined that we should be first and foremost a fighting ship, and so we spent the first part of our time in the Mediterranean simply turning ourselves into a full fighting ship and learning to fire our guns and so on. And then and only then we turned to ceremonial. We had a magnificent detachment of Royal Marines, and embarked with us for this work-up period, which I always thought was so remarkable, was the whole of the band of the Portsmouth Division of the Royal Marines under Colonel Dunn, who was the head of all the bands in the Royal Marines. I think for them to come out with us for the work-up really was rather remarkable. And at the end of November, we went back to Devonport for a final polish-up, and we were to sail on the 1st of February. And at some period, meeting with various people to decide certain details of accommodation and so on. I remember at this meeting, a chap getting up and telling us that one more lady's maid was going to come, one more than we'd expected. But of course, if he said 100 more men were coming, one wouldn't have turned to hear. But one more lady's maid, you had to have a cabin so she could get to the bathroom without being seen and that sort of thing, really was rather a problem. So I was going up to London anyhow, and I went up to London and saw the officer who was sort of in charge of all matters in connection with fitting us out. And he said, he rang up the King's secretary, who said, oh yes, I know all about that. Tell the captain to come and visit me. So I went round to Buckingham Palace that afternoon. And I walked into the King's secretary, and he said to me, I don't wonder you were so worried about having another lady's maid. It is really the most awful reason. But anyway, don't worry anymore, because the whole cruise is off. Well, I suppose it doesn't really matter afterwards how you break bad news to anybody, but it really was the most shattering shock. He explained to me the reason, which was that the King's leg had started to get bad, and it was impossible for him to undertake the tour. But it was to be kept absolutely secret for 4 days. And I went back to the ship. I never told anybody at all. I didn't even tell my wife. I thought it was far easier, she shouldn't know. And I remember that during those 4 days, the Second Sea Lord coming down to lunch with me on board, and I fairly frequently saw the Commanding Chief Plymouth, who incidentally was Robert Burnett, whose flag I flown in Belfast. I realized that we thought and talked of nothing else but the Royal Tour, but I couldn't say anything. And this was on a Friday, and on the Saturday we were going to have a big meeting with my command and other officers in my cabin to go into the exact details of the ship's program, as opposed to the Royal Family's program, during the 28 days that we were in New Zealand. I may say that by then already I had 27 evenings officially booked. And so I said to the commander when I got back, look here, don't let's have that meeting tomorrow, a Saturday. It's a rotten day for a meeting. We obviously can't have it on Sunday. And we can't have it on Monday because we're going into dock. Let's have it on Tuesday. And I knew, of course, that by then the news would have been out. But he said to me, "No, sir, there's not a moment to be lost." And so I presided over this meeting, which lasted, I think, for about 2.25 hours, knowing that it was absolute nonsense, and that nothing was going to happen at all. And I remember saying to the commander, afterwards, when the news was broken, "Did you ever bow me out during those 4 days?" And he said, no, I didn't. But I do remember, after that meeting we had on Saturday, saying to one of the other officers, "I think the captain's making a little light of some of the difficulties." Well, that was my first great disappointment in my service career. I forget which way around it went, but I think we made a signal first to King, tell him how sorry we were and so on, and we had the most wonderful signal back from him. But the wonderful thing was that 3 days later I went up to the Admiralty and I saw the First Sea Lord, now Admiral Lafitte, Lord Fraser, who had been my Commander-in-Chief in the Home Fleet when I was in the Belfast. And within 3 days he'd made up his mind what to do with the ship, because it was pathetic. I mean, the ship's company were walking around just like dogs who'd been beaten. But within 3 days I was able to go back to the ship and say, "Well, never mind, we aren't going to do a royal tour, but we're going to be a fleet flagship in the Mediterranean." One interesting sideline on that was that we had, during the time that we'd had this, it was rather such in the doldrums at Devonport before the Royal Tour was announced, we had something like, I think, 100 national service ratings. And they were due to be demobilized at such and such a time. And when the news of the Royal Tour broke, every one of these national service ratings fell in and said he didn't want to be demobilized, he wanted to come on the Royal Tour. So with some quite considerable difficulty, I managed to work this, and all those national service ratings had their demobilization postponed. So when the Royal Tour was off, I thought, "Oh, well, now, of course, it's quite ridiculous. I should have to go up now and say, 'Well, thank you very much, but now the national service ratings all want to go at their proper time of demobilization.'" But they didn't. They at once fed in and said, "Well, we know we're not going on a royal tour, but we know we're going out, the ship's going out as fleet flagship in the Mediterranean, and we want to come too." And come they did, and jolly good they were. One thing I forgot to mention about the working up period for the royal tour, which, as I said, in the end didn't happen, was our return from the Mediterranean to Devonport. As I say, we had on board this huge band, and heaven knows how many drummers and so on, and a huge quarterdeck for them to parade on. And I remember on our way back to Devonport, about the end of November, we were passing through the Straits of Gibraltar just about sunset, and I turned the ship 180 degrees so as to steam east and reduced speed, and the Royal Marines beat the retreat on the quarterdeck with the sun setting right across the white ensign. It was a very moving experience. When we first went out to the Mediterranean, before we became fleet flagship, we remained with the Home Fleet, who were then stationed at Gibraltar, and took part in various gunnery practices and in the combined fleet exercise. When the Home Fleet went home, we went east with the Mediterranean Fleet as fleet flagship, and for the first time took up our berth in Bigi Bay and Malta. She was a wonderful ship, the Vanguard, so huge and yet so wonderfully manageable. And our berth in Bigi Bay, to get there, we had to turn something like 180 degrees, almost, between the breakwaters in the entrance to the Grand Harbour, and then go stern first down to our buoys in Bigi Bay. Well, For the rest of our time out there, really, we were touring the Mediterranean, sometimes with and sometimes without the Commander-in-Chief on board, showing the flag. And it's hardly an exaggeration to say that as you approached each place, you could almost hear the intake of breath and the admiration of the people who were watching us come in. The Commander-in-Chief was a very, very, very great character, Sir Arthur John Power, Admiral, and as I say, sometimes he flew his flag at us and sometimes he didn't come. But we went to various places. I remember Port Said was one of them, and there we gave a cocktail party, and old Arthur John Power used to, I was of course on the top of the Corte Glera ready to receive the guests, and so was he, and he used to walk out onto the platform at the top of the after gangway and throw back not frightfully sort of virtue comments on what was coming up over the side. And I remember that at Port Said, the first person to arrive was the wife of the British consul, who incidentally was Maltese, and she was French. And as she came over the side with all of us standing up strict in the salute and looking frightfully military, Arthur John said to her, "You do know, madam, don't you, that it's a very old custom in the British Navy that the first guest to arrive at a party kisses the captain," to which she replied, "Enchanté," and kissed me. Blushes all round. There's another good story about him when we visited Toulon. The first evening, I think it was, we found that we'd all been bidden to some large dance given by the Anglo-French something or other society. What we didn't know was that all the senior officers, the Admiral and Chief of Staff and myself and so on, had to go up to an upper room where there were a lot of trestle tables laid out, all absolutely groaning with bottles of champagne. We all sat down, and the president of the club got up and made an absolutely interminable speech in French, which he was reading from notes. I remember he turned over page after page by licking his fingers. And then eventually a toast was drunk to the Royal Navy or the British Empire or whatever it was, and he sat down and all eyes on the Commander-in-Chief. Well, the Commander-in-Chief, as a matter of fact, was a brilliant speaker, but he had no French at all, and he had no idea what this chap had said, and so no idea what to reply. Anyway, he took the only possible line, which nobody could do better than he could, which was the bluff British Admiral. And I can see him now glaring round the room saying, "I've got no speech, I've got no notes, but I can talk the language of the sea to my French colleagues." And he went on in that frame for 1 or 2 minutes and then turned to the British Consul General who'd come over from Marseille and said, "Translate." And the Consul General, who was a couple of fathoms of absolute dripping diplomacy, got to his feet and said, "Monsieur le Président, Monsieur le Maire, Monsieur le Préfet, Messieurs, Mesdames, le Commandant en chef dit que son cœur est plein des sentiments si honorables, etc., 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 mais il regrette qu'il ne peut pas, etc., 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 c'est tous qui est dans son cœur." But I was watching old Arthur John scratching his head. He hadn't the faintest idea what this chap was saying. But one thing was absolutely clear was that the bluff British Admiral stuff was being absolutely wrecked. And at last Arthur John was saying it no longer. And he turned to this chap and said, "I never said all that. Sit down." And I think he said something for our Admiral that we were able to put his leg about his breakfast the next morning. Another famous occasion, when I was out there on the ship, I took a ship to Venice without my Admiral on board, at least as close as I could get to Venice, which was about 7 miles out. And it was the time when Princess Margaret was having an unofficial holiday. She was then about, I think, 17 years old, accompanied only by the then Queen's private secretary and his wife. And as I expected, she said she'd like to come on board the Vanguard, when she heard that Vanguard was coming to Venice. But I thought this out beforehand and tried to think of all the things that might happen. And one thing I thought to myself is, I bet you she wants to say she wants to splice the main brace.